Uncle Don here with the 325th opening of my Porcupine Petting Zoo. The station is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. 70 years ago, the world launched into a world war lasting almost as long as the ongoing NATO invasion of Afghanistan. Just imagine. 50 years ago, I was a soldier, engaged in a battle of my own. I was newly arrived at Fort Clayton in Panama's Canal Zone. After training in the States as an ordnance supply specialist, I'd been shipped to my new posting only to find there was no need for my specialty. If I couldn't go out and find a job, I'd be transferred to the infantry. Now, infantry duty in Panama consisted largely of wallowing in swamps while battling mosquitoes and the ubiquitous ants of the jungles. Not a pretty prospect. After a hunt involving a lot of door-knocking and groveling, I found an ordnance repair depot whose commander was willing to carry me off the books as surplus, a status I retained for over 2 years. I lived in Fort Clayton and had to bum a ride or hitchhike to my job at another base, Corozal, several kilometers down the highway. My situation was tenuous, but as long as I curried favor with the officer in charge, I was safe from crawling with snakes. An onerous job through which all of us peons rotated was guard duty. Every night and all of weekends, 4 chosen soldiers had to don their khakis, draw a carbine from the armory, and take shifts marching around a quartermaster laundry on the border of the Republic of Panama. Our sacred duty was guarding this strategic building from communists. Well, not communists, actually, but desperate Panamanians who had made a habit of jumping the fence and making off with our dirty duds. Now, to understand what I'm about to relate, you must understand that the military is driven by rumor, innuendo, and misinformation. We all knew through the grapevine that this innocuous building, through which our soiled uniforms passed each week, harbored secret technology which the dreaded Soviets were desperate to obtain. From imperial evidence, we knew of a secret machine in that building. The results we saw weekly. There was no denying this. This clever machine ripped the buttons from our shirts and fired them through the toes of our socks. I later discovered that the Russians would have had no use for this clever bit of technology. Until very recently, Russian soldiers did not wear socks. Instead, they wrapped their feet in strips of cloth within their boots. We innocent soldiers had been victimized by another lie. We should have known. The first thing a private soldier learns is never to volunteer for anything. The second rule he or she discovers is that one shouldn't believe anything one hears and only half of what one sees. This does not apply to television, where one cannot believe anything one sees either, but we had no television. What self-respecting nation allows foreigners to buy their land? Trick question. The obvious answer is none. While Stephen Harper huffs and puffs around the Arctic making bold, indefensible declarations about Canadian sovereignty, his back is turned toward foreign purchases of blocks of irreplaceable farmland in Canada's heartland. It's all of a piece. We'll defend to the death vast patches of tundra and permafrost while allowing our best agricultural land to become foreign property. Why not? Recent Canadian governments have overseen and expedited the alienation of our industries. Petroleum pipelines, nickel, steel, railways, all and more gone from domestic ownership and control. We sell our land so we can become tenants in our own country. The average hectare of prairie farmland is going for an average of $1,725. This is 1/6 the cost of Ohio land, below Brazil's, 1/10 of Britain's, and less than 4% of Ireland's. We already have to stand in line behind others to buy our own resources. We pay more for Canadian oil than do Californians. Will we find foreigners getting first chance to buy products from Canadian farms while we queue for the leftovers? A true paranoid, or prophet, might foresee the day when armed convoys carry our wheat, corn, and vegetables south from fortified Canadian farmland. As usual, Canadian political leaders and their foreign accomplices appear to be our worst enemies. In keeping with news of sellouts, our leaders are taking us in the direction of establishing another securities market under cover of fighting global climate change. This is the scheme called cap and trade. For industry and finance, it has been a boon. Governments will give an industry's permits to create a certain amount of pollution. These permits will then miraculously acquire value as they can be sold to other industrial polluters who exceed their quotas. Such a scheme will take the heat off the tar sands bitumen miners as they will claim clean hands by buying credits to supposedly offset their god-awful pollution. It will furthermore give marginal businesses incentives to close down, sell their credits, and run off with the profit while dumping employees onto the dole. Meanwhile, brokers will make a killing as middlemen for these pollution permit trades. The whole system is a win-win, unless you take into account the environment, which will see little, if any, reduction in airborne garbage. Apologists for their wealthy benefactors promote, in print and on air, the continuation of massive bonuses for corporate executives. Their principal argument is that failure to grant multimillion-dollar salaries and benefits to these masters of the universe will drive them away to jurisdictions where they're free to take home lottery jackpot-size earnings. There's no particular reason why there should not be international cooperation in deterring excessive compensation. It would benefit all countries if we agreed to steeply progressive income taxes, approaching 100% at the top, capturing bloated earnings for government coffers. Without the blackmail of one jurisdiction against another, compensation might return to their former small multiples of average wages. Another rationalization for bloated earnings is that their absence would see executives put less effort into their hallowed labors. One recipient of annual bonuses stated, "I wouldn't work half as hard if I didn't get a bonus." Without bribes, this senior manager of a large audit firm would supposedly keep his feet on his desk. An alert board of directors should recognize slacking and fire the offender. If the self-important hotshot is unwilling to put maximum effort into his job for a mere few $100,000 a year, there's surely some ambitious young MBA willing to fill his shoes for such a peddling reward. And maybe the replaced executive will find unemployment an opportunity to spend more time with his family when he's not dumpster diving. Another good reason not to award too much to anyone is that, once they have acquired fortunes, they don't need their jobs anymore to maintain their fancy lifestyles. There may actually be a reduction in work or effort, as managing personal investments acquires more importance. There are millions, if not billions, of people in this world putting in long hours its arduous work for piddling returns. I see no reason to grant obscene returns to self-important desk jockeys. Ottawa pledged $25 million of our money to aid Pakistan's elementary school system. The stated objective is to help schools compete with fundamentalist Islamic madrasas breeding fanatics. Pakistan's public schools are underfunded with patchy accessibility. Certainly a good, non-fanatical school system is key to building a base of citizens who are, in turn, non-fanatics. Okay, let me carry this a step further. How about a chunk of money devoted to making British Columbia's public school system so good that parents no longer want to send their kids to private, usually religious, institutions? With adequate funds, we could have smaller classes with more librarians, counselors, and enough staff to aid special needs children. We could cease diversion of tax funds to private schools and apply the money saved to the public system. There's little excuse for using common funds for separate schools anyway. We don't have madrasas yet, but we do have institutions peddling religious doctrines, not necessarily serving the public good. Can a child really receive an adequate grounding in the sciences from a teacher who is required to hold that the universe is 10,000 years old? Can a child learn to be responsible for his or her own destiny while believing that angels and devils hover overhead? Charity begins at home, and improvements in education should also. We become obsessed with stock market indexes as indicators of national economic health. Any rise in the TSX, Dow, or NASDAQ is seen as a sign of health and recovery. A dip indicates a problem needing solution. When my father owned stocks, he was what is now called a value investor. That is, he purchased partial ownership of a corporation which he assessed to have good dividends and growth prospects. This type of investor is a dying breed. Check out a good newspaper's financial section to find a chart of some stock's price history. Gurus analyze this history as a tool to predict future price movements. They parse ups and downs, drawing trend lines, giving esoteric names to various movements. What is lacking in their analyses is any consideration of the actual business of the corporation issuing this stock. They care not whether this company produces autos or sells insurance. It's the chart that matters. This is alchemy, searching for gold from lead. We've conflated the terms investor and speculator. One who, like my father, buys a piece of a company for the long haul is an investor. One who buys and sells stocks, gambling on short-term movements or without investigating the issuer, is a speculator. Speculators are the main drivers of daily stock price fluctuations. A real investor cares little about such changes as long as the company is profitable, has good prospects, and continues sending dividends. Even in an ideal market cleansed of speculators, share prices will change based on demand and the fortunes of companies. A failing company will have a stock headed for zero, but there will be rational price parameters for healthy ones based on a ratio of prices to earnings. In a speculative market, there are no boundaries for prices. A rising stock can attract buyers hoping to ride it up and sell it before it peaks. This may bear no relation to the real value of the company behind the shares, but a good example is Briex, whose rapid inflation was built on falsified foundation. Nortel rose on speculation to become the major listing on the TSX before falling to penny status. Swings of speculative pricing are exacerbated by the phenomenon of buying on margin. Margin players buy into stocks by paying only a percentage of the price, borrowing the remainder. They hope the resulting leverage will magnify their profit. On the downside, a falling price can force them to sell their shares to cover loans. Forced sales may have no bottom, as sellers must take any price offered. John Kenneth Galbraith's book, The Great Crash, tells the 1929 stories of a young clerk at the New York Stock Exchange who noticed the forced sale of some General Motors stock offered with no takers. He bid $1 a share and, for a pittance, won a block of stock that had sold for a fortune previous to the crash. Serious reforms are proposed to dampen swings of stocks during booms and busts. Buyers of shares would be required to hold them for a minimum time, perhaps a year, before they could be sold. Margin buying would be eliminated, requiring cash up front for purchases. Hedge funds would be prevented from manipulating prices through massive sales and purchases. And finally, corporations would be prevented from purchasing their own stocks to drive up the price. This has become common practice, as inflated stock prices mean those selling for a profit pay only capital gains taxes rather than earned income rates. Executives love to have their companies buy their stock on the markets as it magnifies the value of their options. For the economy, it is an insidious practice as it deprives companies of money that could otherwise be used for research and development or expansion of employment and competition. We know that some financial and manufacturing companies receiving government bailouts have used a portion of our largesse to buy back their own stocks rather than make loans or expand production. They've done this even while firing employees and shuttering facilities. But have no fear. There's no chance that any serious reforms will get past the brokers and fund managers who profit from both ups and downs. Whatever changes may be made, their lobbyists and politicians in corporate pockets will be cosmetic only. We're laying track for the next cycle of boom and bust. But not to worry, the International Monetary Fund declares that the worst of the recession is over. Sure, people continue to lose their homes. More American banks are on the verge of failure. Bankruptcies pop up like mushrooms after a rain. But the speed of collapse is diminishing, thanks to unprecedented transfers of private debt to government deficits. A spokesman for the IMF has stated, no doubt with tongue in cheek, that the crisis has left deep scars. You betcha. We have scars requiring more than cosmetic surgery to remove. Like a bad tattoo, these will remain until drastic action is taken. We have two outstanding problems: the amount of public debt required servicing, and the eventual retirement, and the massive amount of cash circulating. The debt will be retired, or it will retire itself through hyperinflation. If governments are ready to take the heat from bondholders and lenders, all obligations could be reduced to nothing. They were in Zimbabwe, where inflation ran so wild that the government was printing trillion-dollar bills, which would buy nothing. With hyperinflation, mortgages could be paid off easily, but the whole of what we consider wealth, actually just numbers stored in computers, would disappear. The economy would freeze as no one would accept money, and we'd be reduced to penury, even as our wallets were stuffed with worthless cash. the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, published an article in which he wrote that the recession has drained government treasuries to such an extent that, quote, in nearly all countries, higher taxation is inevitable. Of course, he didn't mean Canada. Our eminent economist prime minister has declared that natural growth of tax revenues during recovery will take the fiscal budget back to balance in just a couple of years. Lesser mortals, like economists not beholden to Harper, estimate that the earliest that accounts could balance would be 2013. Even when balanced, we'd be left with a massive debt accumulated during the intervening years. This added debt is predicted to have risen to $200 billion by the time the budget balances. A well-respected Canadian economist said, "Somebody will have to pay. The question is who. It will be us after the economy is back on track in a couple of years, or it will be our children." Stephen declared through his economist's mouth that there is no such thing as a good tax. My humble self begs to disagree. Taxes pay for society, its infrastructure, and functioning. With no taxes, there is no society, just feudal fiefdoms where economy is barter. Good taxes are fair taxes, and fair taxes are progressive taxes. Studies have shown that the more egalitarian a society, the less tension and aberration there is. Scandinavian nations are notoriously peaceful. Surprisingly, so are poor countries, as long as there is uniform poverty without pockets of affluence. Countries where obscene wealth coexists with poverty are usually violent, dangerous places. Look at Russia, the United States, Brazil, and South Africa. If we had good taxes, in spite of what Harper quips, we'd be taking a share of incomes and wealth of top earners and owners while boosting the underclass. We would assure that every child, rich and poor, had the opportunity to learn and excel without favor. As long as we have these self-styled conservatives cutting income taxes at the top while loading fees and taxes like the hated FST at the bottom, we will not have a healthy, cohesive society. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. In 1971's Vietnam, a company of Canadian infantry under the command of one Lieutenant William Kelly ran amok in the village of My Lai, slaughtering 500 men, women, and children. This was but one of many brutal massacres carried out by U.S. troops in the interest of winning hearts and minds in that beleaguered, invaded nation. Publicity resulting from revelation of this massacre helped swing American public opinion against the Vietnam invasion. Lieutenant Kelly carried the can on this one, earning himself a life sentence by court-martial. The war criminal-in-chief at the time, Richard Nixon, exercising his constitutional power to pardon, reduced Kelly's sentence to house arrest. Since then, the former lieutenant has taken a low profile until he spoke at a Kiwanis Club luncheon in Columbus, Ohio. He now says he is sorry. I suppose this is a comfort to anyone who may have survived his murderous spree. Will we have to wait 40 years for Americans, Britons, Canadians, and assorted other nationals who have committed, are committing, or will commit atrocities in Afghanistan to say they are sorry? Is Ignatieff hibernating, or is the press just ignoring him this summer? Harper's publicists have been hard at work making sure their leader's image is front and center in the news. Our prime minister's excursion to the Arctic has been amusing. There is Stephen posing on the deck of a submarine. Do we still have operating submarines, or did he have to borrow one? There is Stephen hopping from a helicopter wearing full flight gear, reminiscent of our boy George Wanker Bush when he made his mission accomplished appearance on an aircraft carrier. The most disgustingly posed photo was of a loving, concerned Harper squatting to speak with two terribly cute Inuit girls. How many takes were necessary to get that smile, or was it photoshopped on his pan later? Not since this callous creep appeared in a fuzzy sweater during his last campaign has such a soupy, atypical pose been manufactured. Harper is known as a humorless, power-hungry, mean-spirited, conniving individual, willing to do anything to pave his way to a parliamentary majority. He has no principles, just ambition. Look at his long-standing goal of Senate reform. His definition of reform involves taming it to do his bidding. Canada's founders, like their American cousins, deliberately crafted a Senate whose lifetime members were appointed by politicians of the day. As a house of sober second thought, appointments were to carry forward the will and power of conservative governments. They would have the power to stymie any progressive House majority which might find its way to election until proper guardians of the elite could take back the reins. Since his days as mouthpiece for the Reactionary Citizens Coalition, Stephen Harper's outspoken pledge has been to create an elected Senate. Members having to stand for periodic election would be subject to the same pressures as the lower house. They would spend the goodly proportion of their time catering to the wealthy and corporations for campaign funds and endorsements. No renegade standing up for common folk could hope to win a seat, and that would suit conservatives just fine. Prime Minister Stephen Harper, champion of an elected Senate and enemy of patronage appointments, has gone and placed 9 more conservative hacks in Senate seats. As he comes within striking distance of stacking the Senate with faithful followers, his enthusiasm for elections has waned. Supposedly, all the people he dumped into the Senate have promised to resign after 8 years to make way for elected members. It's a shame that we have to wait through these years to see how this will pan out. Those promises hold no more force than any other conservative promises. Wait and see whether we have a liberal government in 8 years, and whether appointed incumbents might then not be so anxious to give up their comfortable salaries and perquisites, returning to the rough and tumble of the real world. This Harper turnaround is further proof that the man has no principles, only tactics, all aimed at achieving that majority in Parliament, allowing him to dismantle Canada as we know it, for the benefit of his class. Speaking of Harper's principles, or lack thereof, he has been attempting to win back stray voters in Quebec. Quebecois, having less exposure to English-language propaganda, not to mention television, are better than most Canadians in seeing through the Prime Minister's bullshit. As part of his Quebec campaign, he granted Quebec City's Prestige magazine a revealing personal interview. In this interview, he called upon his reputation for honesty at least twice. He said, "To be honest with you, I am a lot more concerned by God's verdict regarding my life than the one of historians." On its face, this was the statement of a pious man. But what is the judgment of historians but informed citizens' collective opinion of a man's legacy? If, in reviewing the Harper regime's pluses and minuses, tomorrow's historians believe his regime was destructive, might we all not come to the same conclusion? So Harper himself has declared via implication that he places his God before his constituents. He went on to say, "The important thing for me is to preserve family ties. I can win elections, but if I lose my family, it's a disaster." There it is. After his concern for his God's judgment, number two is his family. Many Canadians value their families so much that they sacrifice ambition to family unity. If Harper really cared so much about his wife and offspring, I expect that he would cancel some of his many campaign junkets to be with them. To all appearances, his family members are props for photo opportunities. He walks his daughter to school, making sure that photos are taken. He stands at the door of an aircraft beside his family, all waving happily to the photographers. He sits at home in a fuzzy sweater, a quiet moment of togetherness, just Stephen, Laureen, Ben, and Rachel, and the photographers, of course. Taking his statement about family at face value, this puts them either second or a close tie with God and his value system. So where does this leave his country and citizens? No higher than number three, and judging with his concern for the welfare of the wealthy and their corporations, perhaps number four. As for me, I would prefer to live under a prime minister who was an asexual atheist unloved by the rich. Then, perhaps, his or her attention could be directed toward the welfare of Canada and Canadians. We sorely need a leader and a party in power that will bring our citizens together rather than fragment us in the interest of enriching a coterie of friends and backers. Gordon Campbell chose to lead us up the alphabet from G to H, from GST to HST. As for me, I prefer to think his acceptance of Harper's billion-dollar bribe to integrate sales taxes as a regression, perhaps from G back to F. Henceforth, I shall refer to Campbell's betrayal of this particular campaign promise as the FST. Most of the corporate sector is happy to see this new tax. It's supposed to eliminate $1.9 billion a year from their obligations. Free money, except that the Business Council of BC assures us that this will be a wash for consumers as decreased taxes pass through to consumers as lower prices and, quote, the economic pie in British Columbia will grow faster and healthier as a consequence of this tax change, unquote. Our Lieutenant General, in his speech from the throne, predicted, quote, the benefits will flow through a higher productivity, higher wages and lower costs, increased competitiveness, reduced bureaucracy and red tape, more jobs, and a stronger economy in every part of the province. If you believe any of this, please rush down and place your money on that lottery number you found in your fortune cookie. Off you go. As for the rest of you, you may recognize this prediction as a variation of Reagan's trickle-down theory, holding the tax decreases for the rich work their way down and benefit the schmuck flipping hamburgers at Wendy's. It was bullshit then, and it's bullshit now. Now that opposition to his FST is coalescing, Campbell promises grants of relief to those negatively affected by the new integrated tax. Colin Hanson, BC Finance Minister, admitted that there is a slight short-term impact that will happen. It's not as big as some people are making it out to be. Right. Gordon Campbell did not just spring the new FST on us to obtain Harper's $1.6 billion bribe. He recognizes that overall tax revenues will increase in spite of the projected loss of $1.9 billion in business taxes. Do the math, and we citizens and consumers can expect to be screwed annually out of upwards of $2 billion a year. One wonders how far a government can move toward caring for business at the expense of workers and citizens before the word fascism begins to be bandied about. Pat Bale is hereby awarded the week's award for weird metaphors. When speaking of British Columbia's newly discovered budget deficit, Bale said, quote, the fiscal cupboard is bare and currently hangs on a wall of deficit spending. I think he meant that Campbell's election pledge and that his regime would have no greater hole in its finances this year than $495 million is now inoperative. Even though Campbell's absolute minimum deficit looks to be exceeded by a good $3.5 billion, Bell assures us that certain initiatives will still be pursued, even in the face of cuts to frills, like, for instance, Medicare. The government will shut down the Burrard Thermal Natural Gas Power Plant, a facility providing backup to hydro when demand is at maximum. This just when the price of natural gas is through the floor. Electricity from this plant will be replaced by, you guessed it, independent power producers harnessing rivers, streams, and wind, selling their power to BC Hydro at prices above retail. Private run-of-river operations depend on water, which flows mostly during the spring runoff when it's not needed. Water flow is least in the summer, when demand for air conditioning is greatest. Other private operations are dependent on winds, which blow or not, regardless of human needs. Oh yes, we in our future are in good hands with the likes of this liberal bunch who place the public good above ideology. This concludes the 325th edition of My Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia.